going to stand?
You're welcome to stand. Oh, thanks. You were seeing it. We got it back on. Thank you. All right, we're going to go ahead and get started in the interest of time. My name is Janet Hunt. I'm an assistant faculty member and the practicum director at West Virginia University. Sandra Putnam, who is the wife of a colleague, could not make it today, and her husband was supposed to do this, but he is indisposed. So 11 o'clock last night, I was informed that I would be moderating this panel. We are going to change the format a little bit. The speakers are going to each present for 15 minutes, and we're going to hold all questions till the end. There'll be 15 minutes at the end. And I wanted to let everybody know this is organized by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section, and this is endorsed by Public Health Education and Health Promotion. We have five presenters today. I'm going to run through their names and their presentations quickly. As each one gets up to present, their lead slide will have their name and their presentation on it. The first is Dr. Denise Zabkevich. Who is a faculty of the Health Sciences Center, the Health Sciences at Simon Fraser, and works as a scientist at KARMA. The title of her presentation is The Epidemiological Observatory, Studies of Substance Use and Mental Disorders Within the Corrections Population in British Canada. No, in BC, Canada, 1998 to 2004. I've got it right in front of me. It's pretty sad. I can't read it. The second presenter is Ashley Skoglund and colleagues. She is a graduate student in the Department of Applied Health Sciences at Indiana University in Bloomington. The title of her presentation is Monroe County Drug Treatment Court, Identifying and Examining Factors That Promote Social Functioning. The third presenter is Dr. Douglas Polson. He is a research scientist at Alcohol Research Group, Emeryville, California, and he does a variety of treatment studies. Dr. Polson's presentation title is Three Models of Residential Recovery Houses for Addiction, One-Year Outcomes. The fourth presenter is Carla Wagner. She is a doctoral candidate at the University of Southern California in the Department of Preventive Medicine. The title of her presentation is Evaluation of a Comprehensive Overdose Prevention and Response Training Program for Injection Drug Users in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles, California. The fifth presenter is James Egan. He is a project director with the New York Academy of Medicine in New York City. The title of his presentation is Years of Heroin Use Predicts Abstinence in HIV-Infected Patients Receiving Buprenorphine. I just can't read my writing. Okay, so I'll ask Dr. Zabkevich to start. Thanks,
Jim. Well, thank you all for being here on this last morning of APHA. The work that I'll be talking about today is drawn from an ongoing program of research based at the Center for Applied Research in Mental Health and Addiction at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. The research is carried out in partnership with the province of BC and several of its ministries who are also funding this work. None of the authors have any personal financial interests or other similar conflicts of interest related to the work. Among marginalized and vulnerable populations, the diversity and course of publicly funded services and supports is predictably great. These services, including health care, employment, housing, family care, education, and justice services, are administered through systems that operate separately from one another. However, for a particular individual, the degree of coordination between these diverse services can be crucially relevant to their overall effectiveness. This same group is also known to be very frequent users of costly medical services, including frequent admissions to the hospital. Individuals with substance use or mental disorders are also overrepresented among recipients of income assistance and among those in need of housing. Unfortunately, the study of these more marginalized populations is made more difficult by the fact that individuals are often involved with diverse systems of care and social management in many different agencies and over long periods of time. The ability to aggregate information across interrelated sectors is often an artifact of administrative divisions between the relevant services. For example, addiction services may be administered as either a health or a social service, thus influencing the type of available information that can be analyzed alongside addiction services without going outside the administrative boundaries of the home agency. While it's common for large agencies to collect and analyze vast domains of data internally, these data are rarely aggregated in ways that conform to the known interdependence between social and physical determinants of health and their role throughout the lifespan. The development of increasingly meaningful information systems requires the implementation of information sharing procedures between distinct publicly funded agencies, including academic institutions. For purposes of this research, data sharing agreements were established between three government ministries that are outlined here that are responsible for health, welfare, and the correction services for the entire population of British Columbia. Now, these data, including over 900,000 people, make it possible to conduct studies of long-range trends in individuals' clinical trajectories across different service systems within BC. Further, the data spanning more than 10 years allow us to generate new knowledge surrounding substance use and other mental health disorders and the correction system. Nearly all of the services administered by the provincial government are recorded in association with their respective costs. And this is due to the fact that administrative record systems in the Canadian system are often maintained in part to enable billing and the management of accounts. Now, the simple unit of costs is at once very simplifying here and edifying. Here we can see that those offenders who had no psychiatric diagnosis any time within the 10 years of observation, so the no MD or no SUD group, had an average level of correction costs comparable to the total cohort. Surprisingly, those offenders diagnosed with mental disorders, excluding substance use, had no greater level of correctional costs than those with no diagnosis. By contrast, offenders diagnosed with a substance use disorder had considerably higher corrections-related costs. And yet the aggregate of substance use along with another mental disorder did not result in any higher costs. Now, this same data revealed that offenders with mental disorders were no more likely to reoffend than those with no psychiatric diagnoses, while those with substance-related disorders were significantly more likely to reoffend, regardless of whether they had an additional mental disorder. One of the advantages of this population-level administrative database is that it can be focused on particular innovations within the landscape of policies and services. In the city of Vancouver, considerable attention is being dedicated to improving the lives of individuals who are severely addicted to drugs and who have frequent contact with the correction system. One of the innovations designed to address this population is the Drug Treatment Court of Vancouver. The results I'll be presenting today are based on a preliminary evaluation and analysis of the first wave of clients processed through the Drug Treatment Court. The court began in December of 2001, and the data include individuals who participated in the treatment court through March of 2004. Data from approximately 200 individuals were available for the analyses on these first few years of the court's operation, and about 6% of the correction population who were not successfully matched across all the information systems reflected in the interministry database were excluded. Now, the results I'll show you will be presented over time, where the index year represents the year in which the individual was processed by the Drug Treatment Court. The index years were aligned for all the offenders, along with the levels of service utilization spanning 4 years prior to the involvement with the court system, as well as 2 years prior to 2 years post-involvement. Now, this graph presents the costs associated with services for the entire cohort. As you can see, the income assistance in the green up above accounts for the highest cluster of costs, followed by correctional costs, and lastly, healthcare. It's worth noting that correctional costs include only the cost of sentencing in this population, which typically entails community supervision because only a minority of offenders serve time in custody. Now, among this cohort of treatment participants, individuals are classified as either graduates or non-graduates from the treatment program. Drug court participants will not graduate from the program if they are classified in one of the following categories. Those who withdraw or opt out of treatment will not graduate, and those who are discharged or deceased are also considered non-graduates. Now, drawing from this distinction, the next series of slides that I'll present show the demographic characteristics of the graduates in comparison to the non-graduates. And what we see is that while we know that many females choose to enter the drug treatment court system, males are more likely to meet graduation criteria. Graduates are also more likely to be older and to have been older at the time of their first offense. Graduates are also more likely to be Caucasian. And those with higher levels of education are also more likely to graduate. So now that you've got a sense of who the graduates and non-graduates are, I'm going to move on to show you how they differ with regard to their utilization of services. And here I'll present results over time where the solid lines correspond to the graduates and the dashed lines correspond to the non-graduates. Now, this figure presents the proportion of the treatment court participants that receive services. And we can see that the majority of the graduates were in contact with health and income assistance systems, represented by the yellow and the green lines, respectively. You can also see that about half of the drug treatment court graduates were in contact with the correction systems, and that those folks are in the purple. They were in contact in each of the 4 years prior to the index year, followed by a sharp decline in the percentage who were charged with offenses 2 years following their involvement with the drug treatment court. Now, in this figure, the results for the non-graduates have been superimposed, as shown by the dashed lines. And here, you can see that a slightly lower proportion of non-graduates were receiving health and income assistance services prior to the index year. And again, health services are in the yellow and income assistance is in the green. However, non-graduates show considerably higher levels of correction system involvement in the purple in the 2 years following their drug treatment court experience. But what about the expenses associated with these services? This graph here presents the costs of different types of services among the graduates. And as you can see, there is a crossover in costs that coincides with the index year, where health-related costs in the yellow increase sharply and corrections costs in the purple decline, signaling lower levels of correctional involvement. In this figure, the dashed lines for the non-graduates are again superimposed, illustrating a markedly different course following involvement with the drug treatment court. More specifically, while non-graduates show no meaningful increase in health-related costs, as illustrated by the dashed yellow lines, they present a substantial increase in corrections activity, as illustrated by the dashed purple lines. Now, given the increase in health-related services among the graduates, we can unpack these costs further in order to see whether it's hospitalization, outpatient medical services, or prescription drugs that account for the apparent increase in health expenditures. And what we see is that among graduates, outpatient medical services and prescriptions were the major cost drivers. Moreover, the upswing in these costs appears to begin prior to the index year or prior to the drug treatment court involvement. Now, the non-graduates show a milder upswing in outpatient physician costs following the index year, but virtually no change in prescription drug costs. We gain another perspective on the timing and magnitude of the increase in medical services when we look at the number of claims or the number of service events. Here, we see that graduates begin to see doctors more frequently over the several years prior to the index year. Rates of pharmaceutical claims increased noticeably beginning in the index year, rising to over 50 claims per year. While among non-graduates, there's no perceptible change in pharmaceutical claims and only a slight increase in the number of physician visits per year. Overall, these results suggest that prior engagement with health services may influence the effectiveness of the drug treatment court interventions. This observation raises the question of whether motivation for change is a factor mediating the drug treatment court interventions. Further, the high levels of prescription drug utilization among graduates suggests that the treatment of chronic illnesses and methadone maintenance may play a role in the drug treatment court's success. It is possible that methadone is a significant enabler of success within the context of the drug treatment court, and that offenders addicted to meth, crack, and other stimulants are less likely to be successful due to the relative absence of substitution therapies and associated treatments. Now, our current link database contains over 200,000 individuals and has become the backbone to several empirical evaluations of policy changes addressing drug addiction, prolific offender management, and homelessness within the BC area. We're just now beginning to examine changes within a larger and more recent pool of drug treatment court participants. We're also comparing drug treatment court participants against several comparison groups that have been established through the development of propensity scores, as well as individuals who were referred to the court referred to treatment through the drug treatment court, as well as those who have been referred through probation officers. In general, researchers and policymakers have underutilized administrative data of this sort in ways that are relevant for public planning. And with careful consideration surrounding the balance of individual privacy with the right to good, effective, and efficient treatment in government programs, we intend to work with teams in other jurisdictions to pool our experiences and advance this type of work in an informed manner. Thank you. Thank you.